A lot of folks, even from like the South or like the West Coast, they're transferred from everywhere. So it's difficult to also even know the numbers of where people come from.
This morning, we heard about a raid on a work site on 47th and Western.
In the immigration system writ large, there is no right to counsel like there is in the criminal defense system. So there is no free public defender.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. I know you just hit the play button on this episode about how local organizations are trying to help ICE detainees. Later in the show, we'll give you a quick recap of the news of the day. But before we get to all of that, In the Loop producer Micah Yason joins me for a quick peek behind the scenes. Micah produced this episode. Hey, good to see you.
Hello.
So walk me through the thinking behind this conversation, Micah.
Well, obviously, we know that immigration is top of mind for so many people, especially with increased ICE activity in the city, people being separated from their families. So I was interested in looking into what local organizations in the city are doing for these people and their families. So I was already familiar with the kind of work that Tungo Migrante Chicago does, and we had them on the show today. And I saw that they had started a GoFundMe page for someone named Kuya Darren and his family. And so that kind of got me thinking, wow, you know, we talk to a lot of groups and we've heard about a lot of groups providing Know Your Rights campaigns, what to do when you see a confrontation happen with ICE, like bystander training and things like that. But I was thinking there have already been people taken by ICE. And so what kind of support do they need? What kind of support can they get? And especially the people that they end up leaving behind, like their families.
Yeah, just hearing some of the stories that we'll share on the podcast today really just highlighted how much these families are being left in uncertainty and why they're facing all the fear and what the very real challenges are, right? You know, as you said, people are being detained already. So this is playing out in real time.
In real time. And I mean, these families, they're losing people that are their sole breadwinners.
Yes.
Your life still continues even when they're gone. You have to pay for your rent, your mortgage, groceries.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's truly unimaginable. You know, one regret, Micah, is that I didn't have enough time in the conversation to get into what it's really like inside the detention centers. Anything you can quickly share with us that we didn't learn today?
We've heard a lot about overcrowding at detention centers. Also, the majority of centers don't have internet, which can make it more difficult for people to find those family members or detainees connecting with their loved ones. And also, the fact that some detainees need medication, but they just don't have access to it.
Wow. All right. Thank you so much, Micah.
Thank you.
At the table, Louise Makaraniag, who's a member of the Kabataan Alliance Midwest and Tangol Migrante Chicago. Evelyn Vargas, who's a leadership and growth organizer for Organizing Communities Against Deportation, or OCAD. And Lee Vanderlinden, who's an immigration lawyer and co-vice president of Midwest Immigration Bond Fund. Right now, the numbers are looking like 4,900 or so detained in Illinois. And this is from January of this year to July. What are you hearing, though, about the numbers? I'll start with you, Lee.
Yeah, what's really complicated about some of those numbers is that the Trump administration is purposefully hiding their data. So we're relying and utilizing community networks to be able to keep folks the most safe that we can. So what's good about Illinois is that we have banned immigration detention in the state, which is, I think, a highly positive news. But one of the consequences is that folks who are detained from Illinois get shipped out to bordering states or even across the country. Mm-hmm. So we are seeing some of those detention numbers continuing to rise, but in places that folks have less access to.
Evelyn, your thoughts?
Yeah,
I agree with Lee. It's really difficult. And one of the things that has made it so difficult is that we're not even able to track or find a lot of our community members. Previously, we would be able to go on the ICE locator, which is a federal website where you can look up folks who have been detained or assumed to be detained, and we would have been able to see it within 12 hours. Right now, they are detaining so many people, their system cannot even hold it. It's up to 72 plus hours where we might not even be able to track someone. So those numbers are always fluctuating, always up in the air.
How hard is that making your job?
It's incredibly difficult because folks are constantly nervous about whether their loved ones or their community members are affected. This morning, we heard about a raid on a work site on 47th and Western where day laborers were detained by ICE and immigration. And so it's unclear who was actually detained at the work site, who was able to get away. And then we don't even know how to follow up with the families because at the end of the day, we don't have the information to know who was there and who was taken.
Louise, what are things looking like for you as far as the numbers go, and how is that impacting your work?
Yeah, so for us, for Tanggol Migrante, we primarily work with Filipino detainees. So there's not a lot of Filipino migrant detainees that we know of because, you know, the numbers are really difficult to track.
Right.
A lot of, like, Latino communities, I feel like, there's more mass of them, and so ours is, like, a lot more widespread. And so our network nationally has worked with dozens of migrants, but it's really difficult to find them. A lot of folks, even from, like, the South or, like, the West Coast, are being transferred, actually, to the Midwest, all over the Midwest. Like, detention centers in Indiana, Kentucky are, you know, holding folks from North Carolina, from California, like they're getting transferred from everywhere. So it's difficult to also even know the numbers of where people come from.
Yeah. And before we get too far in this conversation, I want to make sure that I clearly define some terms like ICE arrests, I guess is technically different from detainment per se, right? When we talk about the arrest, that's like the action of apprehending someone, while detainment is that resulting period of holding them. What generally, when we focus on detainment, what generally would you say, Lee, that is the support that a person needs in detainment?
So it depends, you know, obviously it depends
case
on the
by
person, case by case. And
but what have you seen?
A lot of it is just access to legal counsel. In the immigration system writ large, there is no right to counsel like there is in the criminal defense system. So people are able to have a lawyer, that is if the lawyer is able to find out where they actually are, but there is no right to counsel. So there is no free public defender. So having access to an attorney can be very helpful, if at least to figure out what is going on, what are your next steps, what rights do you have, is there relief from deportation that is available to you, what kinds of applications can you file, and that's not even the trying to get out of detention, which has become more and more complicated. I don't want to jump ahead on that too much, but there's been really intentional restrictions on people's ability to be able to leave ICE detention once detained. So
interesting.
The legal landscape is honestly getting worse and worse and more anti-immigrant.
Are you finding, you know, as a lawyer, that you can do less and less from your standpoint?
There's more of a fight always. So the availability to be granted an immigration bond has been consciously restricted by the DOJ and DHS over the past months. So even the ability for an immigration judge to grant you an immigration bond, then for an organization like MIBF to be able to pay that bond for you to be released, there's been more barriers to that legal process. So having that, so in a way, yes, that is much harder.
From what you've seen, Evelyn, is the support that folks are allowed to receive while they're in detention?
It It varies. And it honestly, sometimes when folks are in detention, even their attorneys will have a hard time being able to visit them.
Right.
And so it really just depends on who's at the front desk that day and what kind of mood they're in. And so if you're friends and family are there to see you, they might be able to get 5 minutes with you. Often attorneys will have to beg to be able to see their own client or get clarity on whether their client is even being held there. Mm. But kind of going back to what Lee was saying about the bonds, it isn't even just that there are more hurdles around the bonds. It's bonds will also be granted and immigration, ICE will still refuse to release folks from detention. Mm. And so it's all of these processes and rules that we thought we were following are no longer being abided by. And so the kind of support that we are lending can often what we have done to circumvent a lot of the new hurdles is just connecting with the family members who are free and who are open so that we can tell them what their family who is in detention needs to know.
There sounds like so much confusion that happens.
Yeah.
Right? How long have people been staying in detention on average?
It really varies. Sometimes folks can be there within one day, and we have had folks that are in there for 4, 5, 6 months. And even right now, a lot of judges are pushing for folks to sign voluntary departures, but there is no certainty that if you sign that voluntary departure, you will go home within the next week. Mm. You could still be there for months.
Still up in the air. Mm-hmm. Louise, what has the aftermath of detainment looked like from your lens?
So for one of the detainees that we worked with, Tito Ernie, so he was released last month. And for him, you know, it's about readjustment and getting back to work. And he actually, after he was released, they didn't give him back his passport and his green card because he was detained in O'Hare Airport. And so they confiscated all of his documents. And so it's been really difficult for him to attain his documentation, for him to even be able to go back to work because he has to re-sign his contract. Mm-hmm.
But he's since been released and having a tough time reemerging back into society.
Yeah. And you know, the trauma in the family as well, they still have to deal with a lot of trauma and financial burden. He was the sole breadwinner for his family and he was detained for 3 months. So that's 3 months without any wages, having to pay a mortgage, his kids are in college trying to, you know, pay for their college tuition. And so, you know, like the financial burden and also just not being able to, like, go back to work right away. It is difficult to reemerge from detention.
Yeah. Tell us more about Kabataan Alliance Midwest and Tangol.
So Kabataan Alliance Midwest is a youth and student alliance of like Filipino organizations. And Tanggol Migrante Alliance is an alliance of Filipino organizations that are working to fight for Filipino migrant rights. So that's like an alliance of like 250 different Filipino organizations all over the country.
Wow.
And so we're just the Midwest chapter of it.
Yeah. What should people know about the Midwest Immigration Bond Fund, Lee?
Well, we're a revolving bond fund. So what that means is our idea, obviously, is that no one should be detained by ICE, that we're an abolitionist organization. What we do in the meantime is that we pay for people to be released from ICE detention when they do obtain a bond and when ICE decides to honor that bond. So we fundraise to raise the money to be able to pay those bonds. Then when someone has finished the immigration proceedings or you know, if their bond is breached, obviously not. But when someone finishes the immigration proceedings, the bond money is then returned to us. And then we can use that bond, that money to pay another bond. So that's just the revolving bond fund aspect of it. We also are engaging on some advocacy in reducing and then eliminating the use of detention, especially in the ICE context.
Evelyn, we've talked with OCAD quite a bit on WBEZ and talked about just your organization's work supporting people who are detained and their families. But I know that you've got two particular cases that you've been working on recently that you would like to share with us. One about Gladys and Jonaykel.
Yeah. Gladys is a mom of three amazing children, and she has been in the United States for over 10 years. And she has been part of our community for such a long time, supporting others, giving people information on their rights, and being someone that the rest of the community can rely on. And she had been in the process of getting an asylum. And in that process, ICE had put an ankle bracelet, ankle monitor on her. And so at one of the check-ins she was requested to come into, she was actually detained by ICE, and she was in detention, including in a place called Broadview in Illinois, which, although isn't technically a detention center, is kind of a temporary processing center that shouldn't serve as a jail, but it does. Mm. It's in effect what it does. And she was in detention for about 3 weeks before she was eventually deported to Honduras. And in that moment, she was the primary breadwinner for her family. And her family needed to cover rent and expenses. Her daughter is planning to go into college this coming year.
We're hearing a trend here, right? Mm-hmm. The breadwinners being ripped away from wives, husbands, kids.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And so when we ended up in this fight to keep her here, which we weren't able to win at this time, but we're still in the process of her asylum, the support that we had from the community was raising funds so that her children could stay in their apartment, raising money so that she could settle in Honduras and not have to figure out what work looked like in a country that she hadn't been to in over 10 years, and also make sure that she had connections with therapists that were based here in Chicago, but where she could actually process this trauma that she was handling right now.
And briefly tell us about Jonaykel.
Yeah. So Jonaykel is someone whose family is here from Venezuela, and they also detained him. He was also part of winning money for his family and his income. And after he was detained, his mother also was dealing with being pushed out of their home. And so also that support was not just financial, but we also asked her to come into our space so that it wasn't so difficult to move through this process where none of us have really any real clarity, and we're just discovering it together. And so being part of our collective in our spaces helped her feel less alone.
Luis, you told us earlier about Tito Ernie. What can you share briefly about Kuya Darren and Tita Rebecca?
Kuya Darren has been deported already. Sometime last month, he actually had a removal order back in 2019 where he was driving his work truck and he had a minor traffic violation. When he told his work about the traffic violation, they said, oh, we'll take care of it. You don't have to worry about it. Years later, that was in New York. So then they moved already, you know. They were from Rolling Meadows.
Okay.
And he was arrested in his own home. So six ICE officers came to his door and arrested him right in front of his daughter. And this was a complete shock because it's been 6 years since this minor traffic violation. And so, like, the correlation of, like, why am I getting detained?
Right.
And so he didn't even have a court hearing, right? He already had his removal order, but he still stayed. he went to the Broadview facility, but then they transferred him somewhere in Marion, Indiana. Mm-hmm. And he stayed there for over a month waiting for his deportation. So they didn't really even have to transfer him because they already knew that he had a removal order and no court hearing.
All of that to be deported anyway.
Yes.
Right?
So he was already going to get deported, but they detained him for like a month or more than a month. And, you know, they traumatized his daughter because they had, you know, six ICE officers right in front of his door and, like, handcuffed him right in front of her. And his wife wasn't even home. And so this was a complete shock to the wife, didn't know what to do, reached out. We got their call through our hotline. They reached out and we, you know, try to figure out all of like the next steps with them. They are all back in the Philippines now.
Okay,
safely.
So everyone's gone.
Home. Yes.
So I mean, so much to talk about here. These personal stories. I mean, again, they're connected to real people, right? This is really happening right now. You guys are knee deep in the work. Before this is lost, I want you, starting with you, Lee, to just tell folks listening how they can support your efforts. Anything we can do.
Yeah, I mean, one thing is to stay engaged, stay active in your communities, support your immigrant neighbors. Mm-hmm. You can connect with the Midwest Immigration Bond Fund. We're on socials. Our website is mibfc.org. There's information there about kind of the work that we do and the different ways to help try to interrupt the detention and deportation machine. But a huge component here is just to not be complicit in what is happening in this country right now, which is so against the standards that we should uphold ourselves to.
Yeah. Where can listeners go to learn more about your group, Evelyn?
Yeah. If you go to organizedcommunities.org, one of the things that we have just launched is actually a family guide designed to help folks plan for detainment. Mm-hmm. And so they can fill out a power of attorney or short-term guardianship.
Oh, good.
So one of the ways that you can help is actually sharing that with your community, sharing that in your schools, in your network, so folks know that. The other thing they can do on our website is actually get connected to the Family Support Network hotline, where if you believe you're seeing ICE or any ICE-related activity, you can reach out to us and call us. But we are also forever grateful for any folks that reach out to us wanting to learn more and wanting to know how they can get involved in the stuff that we do, pushing against and challenging ICE.
And as we wrap here, Louise, tell us how we can keep in touch with Kabataan Alliance Midwest and Tangol Migrante.
Yeah, we are on Instagram and Facebook primarily, Tangol Migrante Chicago. And we also have a hotline for folks in crisis. And we are always looking for more volunteers to do direct family support. We do a lot of court support, so we pack the court for a lot of the folks that we work with, mm-hmm. Just to show public support. And we sign petitions, do GoFundMes, and we also work directly with the families of migrants in detention. So right now, our main focus is Tita Rebecca. She's a 71-year-old detainee who just got her deportation order. And so she's just like right now in the process of trying to figure out, you know, and she has also gone 3 months without her medication.
And she's a current case in detention.
Yes.
No meds. 71 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that doesn't look good.
Yeah. And so we're actively supporting her. We're also pressuring the Philippine consulate to actively support her and, you know, try to figure out her appeal case right now. So a majority of our asks is, you know, donations for the family and also for us to keep pressuring both the consulate and the ICE facility to release her.
We'll leave it there. Hope you do get the support that you need. We've been talking with Louise Makaraniag, who's member of Kabataan Alliance Midwest and Tangol Migrante Chicago, Evelyn Vargas of Organizing Communities Against Deportation, or OCAD, and Lee Vanderlinden, who's an immigration lawyer and co-vice president of Midwest Immigration Bond Fund. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now let's get to what Chicago's talking about. I spoke with WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane, Sun-Times national politics reporter Tina Spondelis, and WBEZ reporter and anchor Araceli Gomez Aldana. Claire, good news, good news. The Cubs.
Go Cubs, go.
Go Cubs, go.
So fun. They have clinched a postseason spot. They actually haven't been in the postseason since 2020. Celebrated in the clubhouse wholeheartedly yesterday since winning the NL Central in 2017. That was their last champagne popping, wow, so to speak. So where things stand now, Cubs have a 9.5-game lead for the NL's top wild card spot. So if they hold that position, then they would be the host of a sort of best-of-three first-round matchup.
Nice.
And those games would be held at Wrigley Field, which coach Craig Counsell said yesterday would give them a huge advantage. Obviously, no fans party hardy at Wrigley, which is very important for momentum, especially in October baseball. Right now, the Padres are projected to face the Cubs in the opening round, but there are 10 games left of this regular season, so anything's possible.
Celebrate good times. Well, can you, Araceli, get behind the Cubs postseason run?
Of course. You know, it's hard.
You had to think about that.
I had to think about it, but at the end of the day, Chicago, always rooting for Chicago. I want Chicago to win.
Of course.
Chicago's the best, so yeah. That's all I'll say.
So another thing that I loved hearing this morning, WBEZ arts reporter Courtney Kippers, she was talking with legendary Chicago newsman Bill Curtis.
All of a sudden, I heard a two-way radio from one of our cameramen on the western edge of the city and said, I've got a tornado on the ground. The camera goes on. I look in the camera. I knew, but I had to make it serious. So I said, for God's sake, take cover. Five words would mean life and death to a lot of people, and it would mean the beginning of a 60-year career.
Wow, what a voice, Claire.
That voice.
What a career, too.
What a career, and the news peg with this is 60 years worth of stories being written in his new memoir, Whirlwind. So Courtney sat down with him. That book is coming out this week. Mm-hmm. And about how he got his big break, and really it was a lot of right place, right time, which happens in broadcast journalism.
It sure
and
does.
And he really won audiences over with that stern warning to take cover. And it's just classic.
For God's
Bill.
Sakes, take just, cover.
Totally. Everyone has to hear that story.
I'm going
to
work
amazing.
That into every show moving
yes.
forward.
By golly, right?
Yeah. By golly. Yeah, I was just struck by the fact, Curtis has been around for a long time. He's covered some of the biggest stories, I would say, of this century. But to hear him talk about, you know, as he's been teasing the book Whirlwind in the press, he says he's scared, though, about how things have shifted these days, right? He's like, the government's now reviewing the stories that you cover, and talk shows are getting canceled left and right, you know, if you don't agree with what's coming out of the White House. And so it's just interesting to probably see things through his eyes. This must be wild for him, don't you think?
Because he's seen so much and he's interviewed so many people and he's a local. He knows exactly what's going on at all times. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I can't wait to read the book.
Yeah, I'm jealous of Courtney.
And he has a great laugh, which is so fitting for Wait, Don't Tell Me. Our weekend listeners know this. But
absolutely.
He's the best.
Awesome. Well, switching gears, Tina, because we have all been focused on one really big story here in Chicago this week, and that's immigration enforcement. But fireworks are going off in Washington. So tell us, how likely is a government shutdown?
Right now, we don't know, but we're a week away from the deadline.
Okay.
So October 1st is when this would happen. Right now, Democrats are trying to negotiate with Republicans. They want some clawbacks from things that have happened this year. They want to kind of turn around the Medicaid cuts that happened in the One Big Beautiful Bill. They want, hey, remember the rescission that took away public funding?
Yes.
They want to try to prevent that from happening in the future. So they're saying you're going to get no votes unless you go to the table and try to negotiate. Whether that works, we have no clue. Mm-hmm. I believe that there's about 6 votes that the Republicans have. They need 8 to get this Senate resolution forward. So right now, Democrats, they say we don't know what's going to happen. But things are so different, right? Things are different from March. You had some Democrats voting. Remember, Senator Dick Durbin voted for the continuing resolution, and so did Chuck Schumer. And I just don't see that happening.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened in that time?
Yeah.
A lot has happened. They just see, like, what's the point in trying to get this through?
And I feel like this moment, Tina, compares differently to in the past when we've heard about there may be a government shutdown. I feel like there's so much more at stake now.
There is. And think about the way that people vote. They're scared of how it'll affect their elections next year. We don't know what's going to happen with elections next year. We don't know if there's going to be redistricting. We don't know the normal things that lawmakers are scared of losing mm-hmm. in their midterm elections are scrapped. We're just in a new world. So I think Democrats are thinking, why don't we try something new?
I remember when it happened back in 2018 for that month-long period, and I was working in D.C. at the time, and it literally felt like everything was shut down. But remind us, what kind of effects do we see when that happens, Tina?
Most immediately, you would have furloughs for federal workers, but that can kind of stretch to some healthcare things. Veterans who want to call about their veterans' benefits or Social Security, they would not have anyone to talk to. So it's just people, jobs, but also communication for a lot of like vulnerable populations.
Yeah. Now, Araceli, we know that of at least 30 arrests here in the Chicago area, we've seen that as part of the Trump administration's deportation campaign. A lot of listeners, as this is happening, they've got questions. And you, my friend, have been answering them. So tell us how folks can submit a question.
Yeah.
To you.
It's just, you know, like we've been talking, it's uncertainty. There's a lot of questions. We don't really know what's going on. We hear a lot of things that could potentially be happening. So if you have questions about what's going on with immigration operations or potentially the National Guard coming to Chicago, any question like that, you can send them to wbez.org/guard and we will answer them. And I've been answering a lot of questions and I think I've been seeing some trends that people really just want to kind of get answers to.
Some of the same questions coming in. Well, tell us about today's question and answer from Christina Hernandez in Logan Square.
Yeah, so she's really worried about how to talk to her child about what's going on. She wants to be honest, but she doesn't want to create more fear. So very common question that we've been getting. And so I reached out to Dr. Colleen Cicchetti, and she's a child psychologist at Lurie Children's Hospital. Mm-hmm. And she really said, parents need to be honest. Don't lie. Don't say things like this will never happen here because we don't, you know, things are unpredictable. So she also gave a lot of tips and she had this to say.
Parents need to kind of put themselves in their child's shoes and think, what are they seeing and feeling that I need to help them understand? Because you are the expert in your child.
Yeah. So like thinking about the little ones that are seeing everything and may not understand what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, even driving to work this morning with my teen, she's not a little one. She's 17, but I mean, she had a lot to say. She had a mouthful to because she's hearing things, she's seeing things, and she already has, of course, an opinion, right? And so I can only imagine trying to tell a 6-year-old or a 5-year-old right now, like, if you see that happening while we're out walking on the street, pay no mind to it or, you know, watch as mommy goes and helps or intervenes. I don't know how I would respond.
And it's really just trying to explain and also getting a perspective. Dr. Cicchetti said, like, what do they already know and how do they understand it? Because we understand it as adults, but they might see it differently. They might just be worried about the like a very minor thing and they're very worried about it.
It may look very aggressive to them, too, the interaction. So
these are kids who do school shooting drills since they were very young. So
that's
it is a different generation and a different kind of sense of fear, I think.
Mm-hmm. Let's stick with immigration here. Tammy Duckworth, the junior U.S. senator from Illinois, had strong words for the administration, Tina.
Yeah. Senator Tammy Duckworth is very upset at the Department of Veterans Affairs for using about 12 parking spots at the Hines VA hospital for ICE, for a staging area for their vehicles. Mm. And she says she goes there. She has trouble finding parking. I mean, all of us have had trouble finding parking at any hospital. It's very annoying.
Winding
paths. And so these people are often disabled. It's hard to get around. Mm-hmm. And so she's upset. And she wrote a letter to Doug Collins, the secretary. She wrote that, quote, "It is not too late for you to abandon your pathetic capitulation to ICE," end quote. So some strong words there. She has not heard anything. This is a huge issue for her this entire year. She's speaking out for Illinois veterans, even if it's just a parking lot issue.
Yeah,
but she also
vocal.
Says that people are scared of seeing ICE, too. It's not just about mobility issues getting to the hospital. She thinks that people will not show up to their appointments if they know that there are ICE vehicles in that lot.
Absolutely. Let's turn to city politics, Claire. We talked yesterday about a mayoral task force with ideas for how to fill this $1.15 billion budget gap for Chicago. The panel said the police budget it'll just have to adapt. And now we're hearing from Police Superintendent Larry Snelling. So what is he saying?
So the mayor's office is asking all departments sort of to come up with proposals of how they're going to cut spending or contribute.
Right?
Totally. All hands on deck. So Superintendent Snelling's budget is roughly $2 billion. hefty. Advocates are calling on Stelling to cut vacant police positions that get budgeted for but largely go unfilled each year. Snelling is sort of rejecting that idea outright, but looking for compromise, saying he can trim the salaries, bring them down a little bit to cut costs, but the positions are significant. They do help. So trying to reach some middle ground, we'll see if that sticks.
Anything else on your radar this morning?
Yes, we had a very ambitious story by WBEZ's Mawa Iqbal. She found that nearly 50 instructors at Illinois colleges and universities are on what's called this professor watch list. This was an online database compiled by the late conservative activist Charlie Kirks. This was his nonprofit Turning Point USA. So Mawa actually reached out to each of these professors on this watch list. They were on this list because of, quote, they were deemed advancing leftist propaganda in the classroom. But Mawa truly reached out to every person on this list, compiled some really compelling tape. Several said they faced a lot of online hate, in some cases threats of sexual assault, even death. So it's just really outstanding reporting by Mawa. It's on our website, WBEZ.org.
Yeah, incredible. I heard it this morning.
I listened to it last night.
Yeah,
it
stopped me in my tracks, actually. Great job, Mawa. All right, Tina, we just talked about that city budget there, and I'm looking back at you because I know you have covered many a budget, right? $1.15 billion. That kind of hole. Help me wrap my mind around
that. It's real bad.
It's bad.
Real bad.
So it's as big as it sounds.
It's almost 2.7% higher than they thought. And just coupled with the actual number, there's the environment that we're in where there's rising inflation. There's President Trump threatening to make more cuts specifically to sanctuary cities, Chicago. There's our pension issues. There's whatever's happening with the economy. So it's like a bad number coupled by a bad environment right
now. Yikes. Yeah. Yikes. You've been following everything, Tina, from ICE in Chicago to what is happening in Washington. Give us a story that maybe we haven't mentioned so far that you are paying attention to.
I am paying attention to the upcoming veto session. Just we're forgetting about that a little bit. It's October 14th is the first session, just because there's a lot of ramifications for Illinois and Chicago, transit related things, other things. This is going to be a hyper political situation down in Springfield.
And as we wrap up here, Araceli, remind us again, how can people submit a question about that federal presence that we're seeing here in the Chicago area?
Yeah, please visit WBEZ.org/guard and we'll get in touch.
All right, we've been speaking with WBEZ's Claire Lane and Araceli Gomez-Aldana, as well as Tina Spondelis of the Sun-Times.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Micah Yason, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to WBEZ.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.